KALW.
En La Paz, Bolivia, I became one of the 10 tailors more famous in Bolivia.
A Bolivian father and son talk about their long journey to the U.S.
My dad had me sit in front of his shop so that people would walk by and see a little 8-year-old kid sewing. It was just a magnet for people to see.
Today, the story of Bolivian master tailors living and working in the East Bay. Then we talk about the complexities and culture that inspired a new book of illustrations called Living While Black.
We need more of us out there writing blackness or drawing blackness as we see it. We each see it and experience it a little bit differently, but almost all of us see it with love and appreciation.
A conversation with artist Awan Mance. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The Escobar family has lived through a lot. War, typhoid fever, political unrest, economic upheaval, and immigrating from Bolivia to the Bay Area. But throughout these challenges, three generations of Escobars have honed their skills as master tailors, working for some of the biggest names in fashion, as well as running their own businesses. KALW's Ricky Rodas has the story.
Hey, Claire, how are you feeling?
Good, much better.
I'm at a shop called Tailor It, Gabriel Escobar, in North Oakland. And the owner is doing a dress fitting for Claire, a loyal customer.
Just shorten the elastic.
Let's adjust the seat, yeah.
Gabriel Escobar takes the same care on this dress as he did as a tailor for Ralph Lauren in San Francisco and lead tailor for the designer John Varvatos.
Stand straight.
Sure.
He places pins in the areas where he'll need to make an alteration. To do this, he needs a tailor's best tools, a ruler, and his eyes.
Gabriel, what are you doing?
Well, just trying to pinpoint the right length for her using this 12-inch ruler. Sometimes measuring won't give you the best result, but if you have a good training in your eyes, you can just pinpoint it without measuring it. Is that about right?
I think so, yeah. That's great.
Gabriel marks the hem on the dress and makes a note of it.
All right, Claire. Got it.
Gabriel says people don't necessarily recognize the importance of his profession.
They'll realize it when they visit a tailor for the first time.
And see what a difference a careful alteration can make.
A good eye of a tailor can suggest to you, hey, I think by narrowing the shoulder, you're gonna look amazing.
Gabriel's customer, Claire, definitely appreciates his work.
So we're gonna make him more famous than
he
already
is. Then I will never
be
able to get an appointment.
She's been coming to Gabriel's shop since he first opened in 2018, and his skills have influenced how she shops for clothes.
So when I buy something that's good quality and well-made, it often will arrive and it's not exactly the right fit. So rather than just starting over and never wearing it and buying something else, why not spend a little bit more to make it fit properly? I've done it with like jeans, for example, that I then wear, you know, twice a week. So it becomes so worth it.
Now age 46, Gabriel's hands carry three generations of Bolivian tailoring knowledge. Those hands are used to do everything from make suits and dresses from scratch, make a dress fit just right, or hem a simple pair of jeans. That's what he's doing as he tells me his story. Growing up in La Paz, Bolivia, with his parents, Efrain and Delia Escobar, he began tailoring at about 8 years old.
The beginning was handmade buttonholes and pockets for the suit coats. My dad had me sit in front of his shop so that people would walk by and see a little 8-year-old kid sewing, and it was just a magnet for people to see. I was very excited because I think I just naturally had the urge to create things, work with my hands.
Gabriel takes me to visit his father Efrain at his shop, Escobar Tailors, in Pleasant Hill. Efrain says he believes that his family was literally born to tailor.
My dad, he has his own tailor shop in Cochabamba,
a Bolivian city in the Andes.
The front is for the customers, and the back is a little place with the bed so he can sleep there. I'm assume my mama, when visit him, he went to the back room, and then they make me. Probably they make me in the cutting table. So how I cannot be tailor, you know what I mean? You know? Coming over here.
Actually, thing. As he shows me around the shop he's run since 1999, Efrain points out a slew of awards he's earned.
Thank you.
Aquí está la prueba.
So what are we looking at?
This is del periódico.
One from the 1970s stands out. Silver scissors from Bolivia's then military dictator, Hugo Banzer. Efrain tells me the ruler's wife organized a contest to determine the best tailor in Bolivia, part of an effort to build community support for her husband's presidency.
In La Paz, Bolivia, I became one of the 10 tailors more famous in Bolivia. When Banzer was president in Bolivia, he gave it to me in my hands, the prize as the silver scissors.
Efrain wasn't into the politics, but he did care about getting credit for his talents.
Esa es la foto del periódico, the newspaper in La Paz.
So where are you in this photo?
Oh, here in the middle.
Okay.
That's my wife. She was my girlfriend that time.
Okay.
She was learning and working with me.
And she would go on to work as a tailor for Burberry for the next few decades before passing away in 2005. But Bolivia in the 1970s and 80s was politically unstable. Presidents were overthrown on such a regular basis that it caused an economic crisis.
In other economic news, Bolivia, citing its own trade deficit, said it would stop payments on its $3.9 billion foreign debt for 4 years. The creditors who will not be paid include the Bank of America.
Efrain managed to obtain a visa and moved to the U.S. in 1980, first settling in San Francisco with his brother, another master tailor. For 8 years, he traveled back and forth between Bolivia and the U.S. to visit his family until bringing his wife and kids to the East Bay. After several years, his family was able to obtain citizenship. He worked for Men's Warehouse, but also started a shop with his son, Gabriel. Gabriel and Efrain worked together from 1999 until 2006, when Gabriel left to work for Ralph Lauren. 2 years later, the recession hit.
Because a lot of people lost their jobs in 2008, my dad included. He was laid off from Men's Warehouse. But the good thing is that he had the shop.
The Escobars owe their livelihood to Efrain's father, Felipe, who started practicing the trade when he was 9 years old in Bolivia. Efrain switches to Spanish to explain that, after training under multiple Italian and Jewish tailors, Felipe was drafted into the military to fight in the Chaco War, a deadly conflict between Bolivia and Paraguay in the early 1930s.
Salió herido de guerra y tenía gangrena en los huesos y entonces en los hospitales.
Efrain's father, Felipe, was injured in battle and developed a bad case of gangrene and typhoid fever. The doctors told him that he was going to die. Felipe's grandparents, who were indigenous Aymara and Quechua people, took him to their ancestral home around Lake Titicaca.
But he didn't die there. So with the special food they have in Titicaca Lake, so he recovered.
And went on to become a tailor and a businessman. The Escobars value their indigenous and Latin American roots. That pride's helped them navigate life here in the Bay Area, even in the face of discrimination, Efrain says.
I was working with a Mexican tailor, my co-worker, and then we was talking, of course, in Spanish. And the manager comes and says, "No Spanish here, only English." And then I talked to the manager. If you want me, I stopped to speak in Spanish. Please, first thing you have to do is change the name of California. So that's the way I feel to be immigrant.
Efrain says his family members have been American tailors since they first learned the trade in Bolivia. And this spirit pushes them to do the best work they can, even if it's just hemming a pair of pants. In Oakland, I'm Ricky Rodas for Cross Currents.
Ricky is a 2023 reporting fellow with KELW. You can find more of his stories at kelw.org/crosscurrents.
Te alabo, Señor, tus peces felices saltan sin temor, hasta las aves cantan alegres, agradecidos te cantamos, alegres.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. In 2018, a white woman called the police on an 8-year-old black girl for selling bottled water in San Francisco. That same year, a similar situation happened to black men barbecuing at Oakland's Lake Merritt. There are many stories throughout American history of black people being subjected to racial violence for doing everyday activities. Oakland artist Awan Mance celebrates the beauty of black people's presence while honoring those who were arrested or murdered for their presence in a new book of illustrations. It's called Living While Black. KLW's Janae Darden spoke with Awan Mance.
Awan, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time. Your art is just really so wonderful and distinctive, and it's fun and it's deep at the same time. And in your book, Living While Black, your latest book, you draw black folks doing everyday things like riding a bike, going to the bank, normal things that we all as humans do. But for black people, it has led to them being harassed, reported to the police, and killed. I understand that you created this work during the 2020 protests over George Floyd. What was it like for you to create this art at that time? What was that like for you?
I was really grateful to be able to create art. I was glad that I had access to that way of expressing myself, because as I mentioned in the introduction to the book, I did not feel comfortable going out in large groups at that time and protesting on the streets. But I felt that something had to be done. And I thought, what's the unique contribution, or at least a contribution that I could make from my home? There's always something joyful for me about depicting black people. If there is anything that I love unconditionally, it is my black community. In some ways, getting to draw black people doing everyday activities was joyful for me. Lots of bright colors. I love drawing black people in bright colors. I didn't even have the idea of creating a book at that time, but I did research to come up with, beyond what I knew from watching the news and following the protests, what were some of the other activities for which African Americans had been harassed or arrested or killed. And doing that research was very difficult. It was painful.
I imagine. It was painful when I read it, because I know you have a timeline in the back of the book of things that happened. And it was painful even when I read it.
And so that really colored the process for me.
What I love about the book and your work too in general, you know, I was flipping through the book and the people I saw, they look like my family. They look like my friends. They look like my neighbors. These are just everyday, like the middle-aged black lady writing her check at the bank. I thought of my grandmother, my aunts. You know, it's just, it made me smile just to see those people just doing things that we do in our way, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love that that particular image, banking while black, reminded you of your grandmother. Because, you know, one of the things I've said sometimes when I'm talking about my art is that my portraits, whether real or imagined, come from a lifetime of looking at black people. And every time I sit down to draw an older black woman, even if I'm drawing a specific person for a commission or something, I'm also drawing on all of the elders I knew all the Black women I grew up with, my great-great-grandmother, who was born in the 1880s, and I knew her all the way through high school, all of my grandmothers who were formidable women, all of these Black women and the dignity with which they conducted their everyday lives. It shapes how I create work and how I see Black people.
And I know you also have a book of Black men, and I'm looking at Living While Black to see the brothers in the book too as well, you know,
yeah.
And different types and different expressions and different hairstyles. So what's important to you as far as how you portray Black men in your art?
You know, I really am interested in the ways that we kind of overlook as a society how objectified Black men are. When people think of the concept of objectification, they think of the bodies of white women used to sell things. But I think about the faces, the bodies, and the activities of Black men being used to sell ideas like white supremacy, like Black criminality, fear, all of these types of ideas, and also used in some ways to sell products as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a specific place for the unshirted Black man to sell particular athletic products or entertainment or sports related products and franchises. And when I draw Black men, I want to kind of not necessarily, well, I suppose transcend could be the word. How I engage Black men, I want to come to those representations with no demands, with no needs, with no requests, not wanting to project my interests or my ideas onto Black men about what you should be, what I need you to be. I don't need you to necessarily be the good Black man. I don't necessarily need you to be even, you know, something that's really, you know, when people say this, they say it lovingly, you know, my king. I don't need you to live up to any of that. I just need you to be you.
You know, again, the images are beautiful. And, you know, like I said, I see myself, I see people I love, I see everyday people I pass on the street. But, you know, also too, that it's a haunting story behind each page. You know, it's a haunting story. You have Black While Dancing. That made me think of the Black man who is detained by Alameda police.
Right.
After dancing in the street, barbecuing while Black. That happened at Lake Merritt. Sleeping While Black, Breonna Taylor. I mean, there's so many stories as I was looking at these that was coming to mind, you know, so many just really painful stories. And under these beautiful pictures are these stories where, like, even these things that people do, we're hyper-conscious as Black people when we do some of these things because we know we're so monitored. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, and what you do with your work is to show us we're very hyper-monitored, but we're also erased and invisibilized.
Yeah, and, you know, shout out to W.E.B. Du Bois for the concept of double consciousness. More than now, I try to remain cognizant when I go into a place of how the feeling of being gazed upon changes how I go to the grocery store. You know, I don't want it to. And I try to make myself aware and realize, you know, I shouldn't have to think about that. So I'm trying not to, but it's difficult not to. You know, when we talk about Black representation, there has been a lot of talk about positive representations, positive images, positive role models. And I really don't like that kind of binary. There are the positive images and the negative images, and we need less of the negative and more of the positive, especially when it's used to police Black people's representation of ourselves. What I think is we need more voices. We need more of us out there writing Blackness or drawing Blackness as we see it. We each see it and experience it a little bit differently, but almost all of us see it with love and appreciation.
When people pick up your book or just your work in general, what do you hope they receive? What do you hope your art delivers to them?
When people pick up the book, I want, particularly Living While Black, I want people to see two things. I want them to see joy. You know, there's the joy of the artist in drawing Black people and the joy and fortitude of Black people living their lives. The drawings are a celebration. Even there's a drawing, Crying While Black, and it doesn't look like a happy cry, but just the idea of being able to get into your feelings as a Black person, you know, that's worthy of being celebrated. That is sometimes police. So I want people to see that joy in the color and the expression, and I hopefully people will see these as lovingly drawn. And then where's the hope in the book? The hope is in the drawings. The drawings and their hope represent Black people's refusal to not be who they are on their own terms. And so I hope that this book gives us some of both.
That was Oakland artist Awan Mance speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. Awan's book, Living Wild Black, is available now. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Before we go, we'll hear a reading about a little-known resistance movement in World War II. It's an episode from KALW's literary podcast, New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. Thomas McKenna lives in San Francisco. His book is titled Moro Warrior.
Moro Warrior is a true story of Muhammad Adil, an extraordinary young Philippine Muslim, or Moro, who became a guerrilla officer in one of the most remarkable and least known resistance movements of World War II. And here is one of my favorite parts. 18-year-old Muhammad Adil led his barefoot fighters down a familiar jungle trail singing God Bless America, which he had learned at the American school and taught to them. The trail opened onto a river ford, and Adil, still singing, stepped into the water. As he took his second step, gunfire roared from the opposite shore, and bullets slashed the river around him. He scrambled back up the bank, but realized he had lost his steel helmet and ran back to retrieve it. Skidding to a stop at the water's edge, he could see Japanese soldiers firing from across the river, their machine gun tucked behind a coconut palm. He grabbed his helmet, dancing as bullets pocked the ground around him, and sprinted back up the bank to his men in the tree line, now returning fire. Soon their ammunition was spent and the guerrillas withdrew into the forest, moving soundlessly this time. On the trail, his men searched his body for bullet wounds, but to their astonishment found none, and thus began his reputation as a bulletproof warrior.
That was Thomas McKenna reading from his new book, Moro Warrior. It came out in May 2022. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse.